Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to A Time for Justice. This is your host, Sister Pamela Muhammad, and we also have our co-host, Sister Judge Nichelle Muhammad. And we welcome you to the Elevated Places Network presents A Time for Justice. This show discusses legal and current events in a roundtable discussion of legal minds. We discuss this country's centuries-long failures to apply, uphold, and enforce the laws, and the overall failure of the legal system to give justice, and the negative impacts these failures have had on Black people and their Black families. Ultimately, we want fair dealing. We want justice under the law. But all too often, this is not the actions that we see. Our guests tonight will not make those excuses for racist conduct that is often seen, which are really just distractions from the truth, which is the path to justice and equal protection. So let's talk about just, fair, and equitable solutions, which are in the best interest of the people. Let's remove the distractions. And again, my name is Sister Attorney Pamela Muhammad, and I am your host, Sister Judge Nichelle Muhammad. I opened up your mic,
yes, ma'am.
Sister Judge. Assalamu alaikum, Sister. How are you, ma'am?
Doing good, fine, ma'am. In the name of Allah, the beneficent, the merciful, I bear witness that there's just one God, and that is Allah. And I bear witness that Muhammad was his messenger. I want to greet the audience with assalamu alaikum. And, of course, to my sister counselor, Pamela, the counselor with the Moses. Assalamu alaikum, sisters and brothers,
praise
and all the general audience, live, fine guests that we have set up for tonight.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. So thank you again. And tonight our topic is entitled Perspectives and Solutions to Prevent Our Children from Being at Risk. You know, this is a very important topic to me as we look at our children returning to school. You know, we see our children being given, you know, school supplies and getting ready to go back into these classrooms, but we have to make sure that our children are protected. You know, last week's show, we talked about a time when Black families were targeted. It was known as what you call the war on drugs. It was when Black families and Black youth were attacked. And as a result, those unjust laws caused families to be broken. It caused prison incarcerations to just skyrocket. And so when we look at our babies today, you know, we always have to look at our babies. And number one, we've got to prevent them from being in the legal field. We know that that's a term they like to use, but we want to make sure that if we take accountability, if we arm ourselves with knowledge and belief in the God, you know, our babies, wanting to go into these years with the best possible solution. So that's what tonight's show is about. We're going to get perspectives and solutions to prevent our children from being at risk. Yes, ma'am. Sister Michelle, I tried to open it up, and I think now we want to go ahead and bring on our very, very special guest. We have some very special guests, some experts beyond expertise in some arenas, because anybody working with youth, they just deserve the highest order of respect to me. So without further ado, I want to go ahead and open up our brother attorney's mic. We have a brother Deshaun X Peoples out of Memphis, Tennessee. He's an attorney. He does a lot of juvenile and family law, and he's an expert in this field. Brother Deshaun.
Yes, ma'am. Assalamu alaikum.
Why, Laika Salam, Brother Deshaun. Thank you so much for calling in and being our guest. And what I want to say, too, is that for anyone who is a guest, because we have a couple of guests who are going to be joining us on the panel, please press the number 1 to get into the host queue so I can go ahead and open up your mic and bring you right into this conversation. So while I'm waiting for that, you know, we know that black children are more likely to be placed in adult jails. You know, we know that black children are being targeted. We know that our families have to be accountable. But in order for them to be accountable, I think they really need to be more informed. So we're going to talk about some of the disparity. We're going to talk about the police brutality. We're going to talk about some of the inhumane conditions. But we're also going to talk about making our families accountable. So I see that we do have another guest. And I think this guest, I want to go ahead and open up her mic, if I may, and let me make sure. I believe this is Dr. Damia Harris Madden. Dr. Madden.
Good evening, and assalamu alaikum to you, Sister, and all of the guests tonight. My name is Dr. Damia Harris Madden, and I am from Westchester County, New York, and I am representing myself this evening, so my views are not that of my employer. I do work for Westchester County government, but I am here simply as a member of this most wonderful community, as well as a parent. So thank you for having me.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much, Dr. Harris Madden. And you know, just a little brief information. Our sister has spent over 18 years working in this field, as she's talking to us about. She's known for her expert in grant writing and program evaluation. You know, she's worked for agencies that support children, youth, and families within the 46 communities throughout her county. And so I wanted to just give a brief, you know, info about you, Dr. Madden, because as you all will soon hear, this sister, she knows about the issues that are impacting our children. And so I know that we have one other guest coming on, and that's Brother Reginald Gordon. But I'm going to go ahead and open up the mic, and perhaps he'll go ahead and join us soon. So I want to go right into this. As we talk about our youth, let's talk about first, what are we trying to protect them from? And a lot of people know about this concept called the pipeline to the prison. And so talk to us, you know, for those listeners, tell us what does that look like? What are we talking about here?
Sure. No, and let me.
Okay, go right ahead. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think there was someone introducing themselves.
No, ma'am. Go right ahead. I'm sorry.
Yes, ma'am. And I would be remiss if I did not also thank my dear sister, Sister Michelle, who I've known for decades. And she may have shared, my papa, my dad, was a member of the nation and would be so proud. I know he's, you know, me today. So
I would say that's right.
In working with young people, and actually I still see myself through their eyes as I was a young person that could be defined as at the greatest risk, highest risk, growing up in an urban community with, you know, a myriad of challenges and issues, many of which our young people face today. I would say that, you know, first we look at those social health determinants, and in many regards, we have to add that social mental health determinants because our young people are so exasperated by the many challenges that they face, not just from the physical, but also from the mental and the social and an emotional standpoint. And so when we look at our young people and we do our best to try to protect them from the conditions that we know exist, we cannot dismiss the real importance of the race outcomes gap. And I want to just also say, which I should have said first, disclaimer, because I know I've read about the brothers that will be speaking tonight. I am no expert, and I'm not proclaiming to be an expert in, you know, this field, only one of concern and one that has experienced much of the lived, you know, lived life experiences. But that said, we know that there's an outcomes gap across almost every area of our lives. And sadly, people of color, in particular Black people, experience far worse outcomes in comparison to their white counterparts. And that's whether we're talking about every age, every income level, education level, when we talk about the wealth gap and the economic instability or stability, depending on how you define that, health in particular, life expectancy, rates of incarceration, rates of entering into various systems, whether that's the child welfare system, the abysmal educational system. You know, we every day are fighting to keep our young people out of these systems that, quite frankly, you know, have historical, institutional, structural, and personal implications on our lives. So the first thing we have to do is decolonize our minds, and we have to decolonize our children's minds, because the truth is we know that they're growing up in an environment or environment where, you know, racism is prevalent, and they have to do the internal work. And as parents, we have to prepare them and make sure that they are physical, emotionally, socially, educationally, economically fit to really navigate through all of the challenges that we have. And so that was just a pretty much an overview in terms of my perspective. But if there's specific questions about, you know, what I think, you know, we can do, we can start by acknowledging that our young children are growing up disproportionately with this social race outcome gap.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much. And let me just throw some thoughts out there. Thank you so much. That was such a beautiful response. And I do thank Sister Judge Nichelle for bringing you on, ma'am. I have to acknowledge our sister as well. Because as we talk about the juvenile justice system, which is very unique in this country, you know, we have children as young as teens sentenced to life in prison in America. You know, youth of color are viewed as different. You know, there's a perspective, and they, you know, get harsher punishment. We know in 1980s there was the perpetuation of the super predator myth. Where youth were painted as people who were going to be these horrible people, and it resulted in a relentless targeting of our Black youth. We know things like the movie, you know, from Central Park, the Central Park Five. That was an example of the youth not getting their rights respected. And we know that many of the youth in the system are black. 41% of youth in placement are black. Mm-hmm. And black youth are at least 10 times more likely to be held in placement as white youth. So this is a very real problem for the black community. And so we just kind of wanted to put some of that out there as we talk about prevention, as we talk about solutions. And so, Brother Deshaun, I wanted to go ahead and, you know, welcome you into this conversation. Yes, sir.
Oh, thank you. I heard the sister, and she gave a beautiful overview. But I would say that when we talk about the school, when we talk about the pipeline, we can't forget the beginning of it, which is school. It's the school to prison pipeline. And we lose so many of our children on the school side. Because as she was talking about, the outcomes for black people are different from the outcomes for everybody else. Our children go to school, and you were mentioning that they're viewed as super predators, but our young children go to school, and they're viewed as aggressive. Normal behavior is viewed as something other than normal behavior when it comes from our children. And you can have a black child and a white child in the same room doing the same thing, but the black child is often viewed as doing something untoward and the other child being viewed as just being a child. And our children don't often get that additional leeway of just being a child. And that's the beginning of the school to prison pipeline, because a child who's constantly just irritating in class can very easily end up in juvenile court for any of a number of things. And that's generally where this starts, is they go to juvenile court, and from there they become criminals and end up in prison. And that's the kind of the route that it takes. So we have to definitely be on guard with our children from the school all the way through. And that's just kind of my general overview of the school to prison pipeline.
Sir, thank you so much for that. And you know what? When we look at the juvenile system, and everybody can chime in, because this system, I think some stats talk about 1825, this New York House of Refuge, where, you know, you really got a system that was based on focusing on children whose parents were unable to care for them due to disease or neglect. And, you know, so when you look at today, we see a lot of times with our families, they're single parents. You know, there's this quote that says moms are working the equivalent of 2.5 full-time jobs, about 98 hours a week. You know, so then the question is, you know, who is minding the children? You've got as a result of some of the disparity, the crack cocaine, you know, taking people out of the communities, the whole depopulation agenda against black people, really, sometimes with these laws. We know that our families are poorer than their grandparents were. Older relatives are having to take care of children. We got drug addicted parents, single mothers. You know, this is what we're looking at, and these are the parents and the caretakers of the youth. So talk to us about how the juvenile justice system really like has jurisdiction over people, over children, because children are different. Children, they're not treated as adults in the system, and when they come into the system really assumes a lot of control over them. Isn't that how the law works, if anybody wants to talk about that? Because then we can go into, you know, the accountability issue with how these systems are, you know, possibly doing. I bet in Westchester County, Dr. Madden, you have some good comments and some good you know, possible models that you can tell us about where children may be getting what they need, but we know oftentimes black children in these systems are not getting what they need. So can we talk a bit about going on in their families, some of the needs that we're seeing that's making them vulnerable.
Sure. And excuse me, I'll start by saying as a parent, we see very early on, and Sister Nichelle knows this, raising four queens, I'm raising three, the adultification of our children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this assumption that our children can, they know more, and that may be true in some cases, but certainly they are treated as though they are adults, that their adolescent brain somehow advances much faster than what the research bears, which says that, you know, an adolescent, a young person's brain does not fully develop until 24, yet we treat children in elementary school as if they're adults, and we see this when we have our young people being suspended and being held to a extremely high standard for making very juvenile, if you will, childhood mistakes. So we see this, you know, pattern in behavior, structurally, our young children as if they're adults. So if we start there, we understand that, you know, our young people, our girls, for example, go back to the stereotype that they use to describe us as Jezebels, and, you know, we're hypersexualized, where our children are made to, for some reason, my six-year-old knows more than what a middle school, high school student should know just based on the color of her skin. And it's absolutely ridiculous. And there's so much research out there that speaks to this. And so I would say that. But then when you look at the rate of incarceration, I mean, you know, Black Americans are in state prisons. I believe the stat is 5 times higher than white counterparts. Why is that? I mean, that goes back to Jim Crow. It goes back to the history here and free labor. But this pipeline, as the brother mentioned, absolutely begins in schools because we have those abysmal outcomes and outcomes that have a dearth of resources that don't have the same opportunity. When you look across a county like mine, it is stark contrast when that urban versus suburban people, what they're learning, that's a little bit of feedback. I'm not sure. I'm getting a little feedback.
I do hear that feedback.
Okay.
It's cleared up now. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
Thank
so,
you.
You know, when we look at our suspension rates, as I said, our achievement rate, you know, starting from school as early as pre-K, we see the differences in terms of our educational outcomes for our children. But to your point that was made earlier, looking at the resources that are available for those working parents who can barely afford to keep the lights on, it's very difficult for them to get into programs that are of the highest quality, programs that may instill the same rigor as other programs. And so there's that disparity there. It goes back to the economics of it all. And speaking of parents, you know, many of which are doing the very best that they can. So the narrative that, you know, our parents are failing our children because they are, you know, addicted to substances and alcohol, or, you know, maintain a lifestyle that is so different, I would submit that may not always be the case, and that shouldn't be a first thought, although it was very prevalent in my generation, where you saw, you know, crack-addicted children, crack-addicted, you know, born crack-addicted, I should say, with parents using, and not to say that it doesn't happen today, but we also know that there are other indicators that lend to why, or conditions that lend to why, you know, our children may not be performing as well. And again, going back to just that structural, contextual, historical context, we can't dismiss that. And, you know, when we look at the behaviors of some of our young people, I'll take COVID, and I know I'm jumping around a lot, but it's such a loaded question. You know, some of our parents, some of our children are now bereft of parents. We have to consider those families that were on the brink of poverty, they are now splattered on the concrete. You know, they were holding on, but then one parent was lost, and there goes your whole household in terms of you're making ends meet. You go from struggling to keep the refrigerator stocked to not having food at all and having to go to food pantries or food deserts. You know, so all of that, and we know how important nutrition plays into the way we perform, how we behave when we go to school with empty stomachs, you know, or we come home to foods that's not nutritious. You know, our brains are not being fueled properly. So, you know, parents are working. Some of them are doing the best that they can. But given what has changed, in the last 2 years, the landscape looks very, very different. And I really shudder to think about those children that are, you know, emerging from early adolescence to, you know, middle adolescence, what their life is going to look like in a few years, because they've also lived through, you know, bereavement, grief, extreme loss, and the social isolation that everyone has experienced, but particularly hit hardest in the African American communities.
Right, that is so important. Go ahead, brother.
I'm hoping I'm not cutting the sister off. I'm sorry. I'm hoping I'm not cutting the sister off, but she touched on something that really, really hit home for me, because I speak in a lot of schools. I actually speak to the children. And one of the things that I've seen is that we talk about the effects of COVID on our children and such. It's affected our children not just in the places where they've lost a parent and so forth, but it's affected our children in the same ways it affects many of the adults. I've seen teenage girls who were extremely outgoing prior to COVID who now have extreme social anxiety in terms of even just being in a classroom. And one of the big things that's
been an issue for me lately, because every issue affects our community harder than it does others, but it's the fact that our children don't get the benefit of the doubt, and our children don't get the same rush to receive counseling that others do. When there's a disaster in most communities, you see a rush of psychologists. You see people talking about the psychological effects on the children. But when it happens to our children, you never see that. And so they essentially have to just go on, deal with the trauma, and we pretend like it doesn't exist. But our children carry a lot of weight. And as a result of that, some of their behaviors show through that if they were given the opportunity to be children, if they were given the opportunity to have somebody at least acknowledge that they're dealing with something, we could bypass some of this. But when she talked about the adultification of our children, it starts early on and it continues all the way through. And it's our girls and our boys. The boys are viewed as men and the girls are viewed as sexual, but the boys are viewed as predators. And we have to deal with this because at this point, it's our community that views our children this way too. And we have to get to a point where we see our children as children. And when we get there, then we can force others to do it. But we have to grow back to that point, because it's hard to fight a fight when the other people in the fight don't see a fight. And that's why shows like this are important, so that we can remind one another that we're talking about our children. We're talking about our legacy. And we have to remember that while they may be smarter, they may be able to jump higher, they may be a lot of things, but they're still making childhood mistakes, and they have to be viewed as children when they make them.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And that's so
right.
We do
that's
have
right.
Brother Reginald Jordan. He's joining this conversation. And before I bring him in, I wanted to extend this and say, so as we're talking about the vulnerability of youth, because they're vulnerable, we're talking about their vulnerabilities, but we're talking about a system, right, that shouldn't make them worse. We, Brother Deshaun, you have a situation in Shelby County, Tennessee, which is where you're from, where they're talking about
mm-hmm.
black children being more likely to be transferred to adult jails, where this, you know, they're just turning to monsters a lot of times, being subjected
mm-hmm.
to that type of torture. In the final call, they have an article talking about how London, and this, and, you know, and this is just to show this is a national thing. London police strip searched 650 people, mostly black youth, in a 2-year period, according to a report. And they're saying that 75% of the youth in 2018 who were strip searched were black, 10 to 17 years old. Between 2018 and 2020, they're saying at least 58% are black. So what type of trauma, you know? And then we got down here in Texas where they've got these children in the youth system, the juvenile justice prison system, what we like to call it, Texas Youth Commission. They're staying in their cells for 23 hours a day at a time. You know, the suicide rates are really up. You know, just really inhumane conditions. So, again, the vulnerability of the youth, you know, coming into systems that don't care about them, as well as failure to prevent, failure to intervene, you know, this is really causing a problem. So I just want to bring in Brother Reginald, but I also wanted to say, so one of the keys is that we got great experts who are given this information, and I have to give a shout out to our sister Sherelle Muhammad, who is a student at Howard University, who I got a lot of the stats that I put before us from an interview that Sister Sherelle did, because she's going on to want to work with our youth too. So Brother Reginald Gordon.
Yes, ma'am. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
And you know what, I'm probably going to have to mute my phone because you're, I merged you.
Yes, ma'am,
so,
can you hear me a lot better?
Let me see, I'm going to mute my phone and you go ahead.
Yes, I just want to just thank you for inviting me into this conversation tonight, and I think this is, and like I say all the time, it's a much needed conversation. You know, I'm going to go back on my history when it comes to why I feel like our youth have been, you know, is doomed for almost annihilation. And from me in the 40 years, I've been working with the communities and dealing with creating programs and trying to find resources to help work with our young people in this area. And you know what I'm saying? Because, you know, my personal lived experience, you know, take me through a tunnel that, you know, at the age of 16, I end up in prison with 200 years, where I end up in the juvenile justice system. So when you speak about dealing with the juvenile justice system, but I'm going to go back to where it goes back to what we have to at this time, you know, if we don't deal with the ACE effect, going back to the families, the adverse childhood experiences that we done went through, that then called a lot of the behaviors of our young people and the behaviors that underdevelop our minds, and how we must also look at how the stressful, the toxic stress then played a major role in how our young men have been channeled through this school to prison pipeline. I say that to say this because as we come from, you know, mostly young black men that I deal with come out of the urban areas, the where we know that environmental problems deal with lead in the water. So we deal with all these underdevelopment things that we come through families. Then we get to the public school, to where in the public school system where we know even when I got there, I had what you call a mental illness that was not diagnosed at an early age. It was called dyslexia, which I understood later on that a lot of young brothers that even in prison, we know that 80% of the brothers read at a sixth grade level. Well, we must go back and ask the question. If we know that the brothers, 90% or 80% of the brothers read at a sixth to seventh grade level, that's in prison, you know, and most of them that was diagnosed come up with that, with a study done a few years ago that dyslexia played a major part in the brothers and them not able to read, being able to read. So I think that we live in a society that have capitalized on young black boys specifically that I have been affiliated with, and knowing that we haven't got the proper treatment, we haven't got the proper safety nets around our own personal community to deal with some of the behaviors that the society have put up on young, especially young black boys. So I'm thinking about the studies that you just talked about dealing with the TJJD, the Texas Juvenile Justice Department, that I've been working with for the last 20 years, knowing that like that in Texas here, you know, the juvenile justice system have the worst record for teenage rapes and teenage rapes amongst our young people. So we're dealing with a lot of other issues that young people come out that we know that that when they come out these institutions, a lot of our young men, since the prison system is set up for the strong take advantage of the weak, and a majority of the young brothers that get in there that don't survive the lifestyle of jails and prisons, they come back with this anger, that's animosity, because they come back with the deep-seated secrets of having to sleep with other men, forcefully sleeping with other men. And we deal with all these issues that we have refused to talk about. But, you know, these are some of the things that I said that we must study. And for the last 5 years, a lot of my study have been around, you know, trauma-informed care. How do we come up with programs to deal with trauma-informed care? Because, again, until we treat the pain, we're not going to ever do play with the symptoms that young black boys that I especially deal with on a daily. We treat the symptoms because we a lot of times the programs that we get involved with or we get affiliated with do not go past dealing with the root cause of the problems that our young boys deal with. It was a study done that I read about in the Jewish community in Germany where they did a lot of studies. Scientists did studies on the kids of the Jewish community. They find that the brain had overdeveloped from the transgenerational trauma that a lot of the children take in from their parents and their grandparents. So I think that it goes back to where if we're going to be effective in this work that we're doing, we have to be aggressively attacking and deal with the root cause of why a lot of the issues that we've been fighting and dealing with for the last 30, 40 years, when it goes back to why our children are sent through the school to prison pipeline, we're the highest in the list in special ed. We're in special ed class. Our boys are suspended more than any other boys, expelled more than any other boys in the school, you know what I'm saying? We're reading at an inadequate level. So all these different things we've been knowing about, and we talk about them. You're saying when you get to the third grade, we already know that they done already built enough prison beds for young black boys because they know that their reading level is not a par to get them through high school or college. So this is some of the work that I've been trying to engage men, black men specifically in. How do we pull the mask down and work with the root cause of the issues in our pain to get us somewhat focused to where we can do some serious work and deal with our young people? Because, again, I had to rehear and over the years, me doing a lot of self-care, meditation to reestablish my thinking processes and my brain set, and how do I move forward through this journey and dealing with this system. So I think that's where we at when it comes to the work that we're doing in the recovery area, because again, as we travel from the 70s, the 80s and the 90s, as we went through the crack, I heard the sister talk about it, the crack cocaine era, where we was, you know, we dealt with it. We swept it under the rug. We filled up the prisons. We never was able to get those brothers the actual treatment that they need coming through all that trauma from the crack cocaine era. Right now, in this new movement that white America see that young white kids are ODing at an alarming rate with these opioid pills, you know what I'm saying, that's laced with all kind of fentanyl and, you know, elephant tranquilizers. That's, so therefore, here we are at this time in the 2022 to where a new attack is coming in on our community, especially our young boys that's trying to find a way to keep them self-medicated to where they have no way of getting themselves properly back into the educational system and fighting at a level to where we know that we can get this thing under control, especially this violence.
May I just add, I hope I'm not talking over anybody. Thank you for just, you know, elaborating on the ACEs. I wanted to just add that, you know, it was very interesting, the work that I do sometimes when I'm speaking with the young men who have had, you know, lived experiences with the criminal justice system or just child welfare system. It's really interesting how, you know, we tend to try to define your trauma based on the, you know, standards, if you will, or the criteria that's been set by others, when, you know, so often we miss how these young people explore and actually define their own trauma. And we have to allow them to do that because, you know, we're not all one. And, you know, what it feels like to be harassed at school or bullied at school is different from being harassed on your own front steps. You know, there's an article I was reading the other day that spoke about that. And for the attorneys on the line, I believe it was about the reasonable black child. And it opens up by speaking about those experiences that young men in particular have that we really, you know, seek to understand and define. I just wanted to add, what you said was so important because there's just a whole host of things that lend to those ACEs, and it's really difficult, at least for somebody like me, to sit back and say, well, you know, I'm not defined as a clinician, but it's easy for me to tell you, you have depression and you have anxiety and you have social disorder, et cetera, right? But what we're missing is, what do you believe you have, right? How do you think you might overcome that? And is that necessarily defined by the criteria that, like, established by others? And we have to be careful because as fully formed adults, we know how we want to be defined. And make that mistake of putting those definitions on young people. Let them tell you. It's kind of like when I ask young people who have, you know, used guns and have shot a gun, and I say, what is it that you think you might do different, or what you think could have been put in place for you not to resort to picking up a gun? We know that there's self-preservation. We can imagine that because we've been in neighborhoods. Some of us have grown up in those neighborhoods, and often we're picking up, you know, a weapon just for protection to feel safe. It's a false sense of security, but still we must have, right? But the responses can be so general. It will, for me, it knocked me over when young men could tell me that taking a hike or having a conversation with an elder might have changed their course in life. You think that's right. So simple, right? That they're so hard and that couldn't possibly be the answer. It's the same thing when we talk about what's the trauma that you've experienced in your life. It really needs to be up to them to kind of define that. And, of course, assist where they have the lack of words to kind of put it in a clinical format. But, you know, I just wanted to highlight that point because I thought it was really important and it popped into my mind as you were speaking.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. And, you know, you're right on point. I mean, and that's what I, you know, especially in the new field of trauma informed, where we allow young people to give them the power to meet them where they are so therefore they can, you know, try to speak on the issues that they're dealing with. And you're like, and you show right when it comes to how do we allow young men to express themselves when they're feeling depressed, because that is an area where young men, especially black men, that I find is not allowed, especially in the black community. We're not allowed to express our deepest feeling of chronic. If we have depression, chronic depression, I mean, even though that is considered a mental illness in our communities and around people that's trying to love us, they look at that as a form of laziness, of not being want to engage. So we have to seriously look at how young people and how this trauma have affected young people, and how do we approach it, and how do we deal with it on a level and meet them where they're at, and work with them through it, and finding out what resources can we bring to the table to where they can speak on what they actually need, and you can help them find the proper resources. But I tell people all the time that a lot of time as an anger management counselor, that I in my anger management class, you know, a lot of times when you're going into those areas of dealing with young people in the trauma, you got to know how to shut that down, even be there to give them the space in the proper area to either vent it out, because you don't want to really open that up if you can't really shut it down or work with them to get them the proper help that they need in those areas.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And yes. Let me, can I be heard? I want to make sure you all can hear me because I switched phones. But, it reminds me of an article written in the final call entitled Who is the Natural Enemy of the Original Man? And this is by the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. This is a July 19th, 2022 article. And I think it's really relevant because the minister is telling us that we have to break up the colonial status of the black community. I mean, as sisters, we can really see it when, you know, we have to go to Korean or whoever to get our hair. You know, we have to get somebody else to service our needs. You know, we don't really control a lot of our own products. And so that's the colonial status. You know, white people own the liquor stores or whoever owns, but a lot of times we don't own these things. And so even listening to you all talk, and Brother Reginald, I know you were saying, what we have to, kind of do to actually help our own youth. So I just wanted to quote the minister. He said, so we have to break up the colonial status of the black community. He said, you can't make this community a decent place to live unless we control the education. He said, the education is part of the trick. And so, you know, he goes on to say, you need an education that will make you love you, that will make you see what you have contributed to the onward march of civilization. And so, you know, again, when we talk about the issue of disproportionality, I know at one time in the courts they were saying one of the big solutions is black service providers. You know, you need black children, black educators, black counselors, black people who understand, black judges, and administrators. That's just a thought that I wanted to put out there. Black attorneys.
Black attorneys.
Right.
Brother Deshaun, did you want to add anything? Sister Judge Nichelle, please, chime in if you would like to as well.
Well
if
I
could,
yes.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I'll go after you, brother. No, sir. Oh. Go ahead.
What I was going to say is that you are 100% right, and that I think is at the root, is that we have to change the mindset. If we control the school system, if we control what our children are taught, if we control the way that we see ourselves, we would solve a lot of these problems, and that's kind of at the root of all of it, is that we have to see ourselves as a people, and when we get to that point, we can address a lot of these other issues. The solution has to be us. The solution has to be the parents, and the solution has to be the community, because nobody else is going to step in and do this.
That's right. Yes,
that's right.
If I could be heard, yes, so much has been said by this eloquent, you know, host of together, definitely acknowledging what the issues are. And we know what they are. You know, you just had a master plan from the very beginning that we were set up to fail. And it's clear across every part of our lives. And so we are dealing with on purpose design to keep us back, starting from when we're babies and making sure that the education is no good. Animals and things that
your phone is out of it.
Can you hear me, sis?
That's better. Come, yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am. Okay. And
no.
Some of the solutions, and I just wanted to add, can you hear me, Sister Pamela, or not coming through clear?
You're coming through clear now. Stay where you are, Sister Judge Michelle. Go ahead.
Okay,
yes
ma'am.
Ma'am.
Am I clear right now? Good. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
And
are.
So one of the things I wanted to mention that came up, a few things. I've seen people in my courtroom arrested for stealing a candy bar. Of course, it was a minority child, and I couldn't believe that somebody would even bring the case. In addition to that, the sister Damia Harris indicated, you know, something very clear that when they come into the courthouse, you know, it's for the smallest of things, and lots of times they don't even comprehend, and they're being treated like they're adults, and they should have known better, not with the love and the care that they should have. So I believe someone talked about the solution about, you know, having lawyers,
yes, ma'am,
and minorities
teach
to deal with, you know, study. Well, I was involved in that, and one of the things that they talked about at the end is that lawyers, judges, social workers, 70% had childhood trauma. But the thing was, well, what did you do? What happened in your life that despite this trauma, you were able to basically survive and do well? And it was
right.
Identified that we all had that person or someone who took the time. I believe it was Dr. Harris Madden that indicated, you know, someone, if I had just had that talk, if someone had just said something to me or giving me that hour and debriefed me or showed some love, it would have changed. And we had determined in that session that that's exactly what we all had. There was somebody or something that it took the pain away and let us recover from that trauma, so we start to see how important we all are in this puzzle of fixing what was done on purpose. So, yes, you got to have judges that do that. One of the things I identified in my courtroom is that when children got into fights in the school, one of the children would get suspended. But then when they're suspended, there's no at-home services. They'd be sitting home for a month or more,
yes,
before someone is giving them the tutoring services. That's a plan. So what did I do as
right.
a judge? I said, I'm not allowing you to suspend them. The school is going to figure out how to keep those children separated while they heal, but they're both going to that damn school. And that's because I'm a black judge and I know better. I'm a child home just because he had a little physical altercation with another student. No, they're coming back to school the next day, and the school is going to figure out how to keep them separated and give some security to make sure they're good. But they're going back to school. So I'm not being a participant in allowing you to suspend these children and then send them home where there's not going to be a catch-all, and now their learning is stopped. I'm not doing it. The candy bar student, I'm not doing that. You better figure this out today. Or guess what?
Yes.
I dismissed the case. Period.
Yes.
So, yes, we
yes.
are part of the solution. We have to be in every facet of their lives as guardians and angels to make sure that we're taken away what is a plan to keep them down. And we have a responsibility, and I think brothers and sisters like we have on this particular call for them. And what I'm going to say is it's a hard job. It takes a master teacher at the very elementary levels to deal with this stuff that they've done to our community. And I thank the brothers and sisters for what they're trying to do. And may God bless them for being in this war on our children.
Yes, ma'am. Excellent. And let me say this, two things, Brother Reginald. I want to open up the line because we have callers, and if anyone has a comment or a question, please press the number one to get into the host queue. And also, I want to properly introduce that Brother Reginald Gordon. He works with Operation Outreach, known as OG1. That's Operation Outreach, and they empower youth through educational methods, and that's in the city of Houston. Go right ahead, Brother Reginald.
And, yes, ma'am. I want to say, in the last 4 years, until we get to the area of humanizing men, we can't send brothers to prison for 10, 15, 20 years and allow them to come back out undereducated, traumatized, and in worse a condition than what they are. When we deal with the juvenile justice system, just like you talked about, where they're locked up for 23 hours a day, half of them are causing body harms to get out their cell just to get attention, but you're spending $441 a day to keep a juvenile locked up. So we got to be honest about where's this money going? Are we still in a slave-like condition to allow a system to use brothers to make this kind of money on them and return them back to our community where we got to try to figure out the eternal trauma that you build up on them in these institutions? So, we have to, like I said, start working with our young people outside of the box. And it goes back to what, the great John Henry Clark said, a powerful people cannot afford to educate the people that they oppress, because once they learn the truth about education, they ain't going to ask for power. They're going to start taking power. So we got to get back to the thinking on how we not build young people or young men to where we keep dumbing them down or allowing them to get caught up in a system that we know that's using them as using them for the revenue that they make off of them and returning them to our communities in a worse condition than what they are in. So, that's why it's so important that we figure out how to unify with OG1, that the issues that we work with every month on dealing with brotherhood breakfast, getting brothers in a safe spot to really open up to deal with the issues so we can kind of come up with some of the solutions and how we go to take over these schools, we go to take over these jails, we got to get together and take over some of the other areas that causes havoc on young black boys specifically. So this is the issue in my plan that we some of the solutions at this time and where we at, if we're willing to get our community back, because even in prison, one of the first things that young men learn from the street to the prison, they learn that you go through, if you're going to survive prison life, you better learn to respect your next fellow inmate that you have. So therefore, until we get back our community where we galvanize like the Italians do, when all the people come in our neighborhood, we let them know you're welcome, but you're not going to come in our community and destroy our women, our children, and our grandparents. So therefore, other than that, I think that we are at that point in dealing with this system that we consistently complain about producing and dumbing down our young men and our young ladies, especially with the family structure and this prison system that's designed, like the sister just said, it's socially set up and designed to keep us failing.
No, and you're so right. Great point, because, again, the stat I got from Sister Sherelle is that the annual average cost of housing one juvenile in jail, and that's the average, is like $88,000 a year. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Anybody know some? Right. And so when you start talking about housing, $88,000 a year spent to incarcerate, what about if you spent that money in intervention, in prevention programs? One other question I want to just bring out, as Sister Judge Michelle was speaking about the compassion that a judge from the bench, you know, she's able to look at the needs and look at what will help these youth by assigning them to stay in school. You know, one of the things in our community is that we are neglectful. In the community, there's in CPS, there's a term called child neglect. It's not abuse, but it's neglect when we're not paying attention to the needs. And I think media plays a role in keeping us away from our youth as well, because we kind of look at them as not being who we once were. And so does any, you know, and today we see this media kind of ramping up again, I think, trying to encourage us not to look at the needs of our youth. And that's, again, why it's so important that as school is starting, that those of us who are in this community who have a voice, who care, we have to let our voices be heard. So did anyone want to talk about the child neglect or, you know, just this whole, what the criminalization campaign, because that's what they did in the war on drugs. You know, they criminalized in the media black people as, and some of that was not true, you know, so we have to be so careful. Does anybody have any comments on that?
I'll jump in to say I agree, not just from the legal side, because that is so critically important. We have more black judges, black attorneys, people engaged in the juvenile justice system, but also on all sides, because if we don't have opportunities created, if we don't actually create those opportunities, I should say, what we'll see is more programs that superficially serve these children. We'll see heightened influences by the outside on our children. And you said this earlier about accountability. We ourselves have to take accountability for making sure that our children are prepared for their future and to have resilience, as Sister Michelle alluding to. What is it that makes some of us succeed and others not? And so social media is an example of something that is just so pervasive, and it's so overwhelming at this point. It's ingrained in all of our lives. I mean, I would be telling falsehood if I didn't say I'm on Facebook, right? I restrained for 9 years, but I eventually went back. And, you know, it's something that our young people are actually basing their entire being off of, their self-worth off of, how they look, how they feel. But if we don't have opportunities that are created to interact at, we'll just continue to perpetuate this cycle. And so when we create opportunities, they have to be culturally and linguistically competent. They have to speak to the young people where they are and in a language that they understand. And we are not going to leave out the realities of identified culture, right? But we're going to know both sides of that. And creating those opportunities for them to become leaders and support their own growth, but also to take accountability for what they do. If they're going to go online and bully somebody, take accountability and responsibility for that. Would you want that to happen to your sibling? Probably not. I'm going to just also interject another thing as it relates to social media, because there's a lot of programs that talk about how they're going to address social media and they're going to, you know, create opportunities for young people to learn about healthy relationships and how to be a better friend and not to bully and not to do these things. But those of us in positions that are in nonprofits or in government that actually create funding or create funding opportunities for these programs to exist, we have to ensure that their work is trauma-informed, but also is there's a race equity lens embedded. And that's some of the work that I do, making sure that I'm looking for organizations that are hyper-local, grassroots, but also have the capacity to teach our young people to actually have a positive influence on their lives, because it's a real thin line when you're looking at these organizations or individuals in the community, as I mentioned before, and working with Gun Involved or Justice Involved youth, they may have said, I needed that mentor, I needed that sponsor, I needed someone to intervene. But then we have to hold those folks accountable as well. And so quality is really important, because as we talk about the professions such as lawyers, educators, program directors, counselors, you know, doctors, we want to make sure that they are offering the highest quality, because that's what our young people deserve and that's what they need. So I know I departed a little bit from the social media part, but I had to get that piece in there because, you know, naturally we look to these programs in our communities and these services in our communities to help support our youth. But we should be looking at creating more opportunities for our youth. And it's a whole different set of skill sets that's needed for that. And everybody that comes around and says, I got this great mentoring program, is not qualified to handle our young people and should not be dealing with our young people, because then there's that other side. When we don't hold folks accountable, they blood suck from us. They will take monies and say they're going to make a change. They will take monies and say they're going to address bullying. And at the end of the day, they may not be doing those things, or they may be ineffective and they don't seek the tools to continue to upgrade their offerings, if you will. And so as we look at professionals and we look to make sure our professionals are diverse, we have to also look at the quality that they bring to the table, because as a parent, I need to feel comfortable in trusting my children with someone that is not me. And so I want to make sure that that person, we're not talking about having the highest degrees. We're talking about having that compassion, but having the skill set so that they're able to counteract those really strong influences like social media, like this dominant culture that is messaging to our children certain things.
Yes, ma'am, Dr. Harris Madden. And that's so important, you know, but in also in places like Texas, as I'm listening, I know Brother Reginald is familiar as well. Oftentimes, we as Black people are locked out of the system. It's kind of like the foster care system, where they'll screen and allow people who aren't Black to have our children, and we can't even get in access. And I can remember back in the 90s, you know, white people, and I just say it because the Texas State Attorney General did big probes on how they people would get money to open up camps, wilderness camps, and, you know, just all kinds of just taking the state's money to provide services, and they weren't giving our youth anything. But Black people, sometimes we have a hard time accessing them. And that's why one of the things I like to get youth before they even enter systems, where you can still, you know, maybe access them at the church, or you can go to the community center. You can go to the school environments, and that helps. That form of intervention is also important. Sometimes, and you know what? Here in Texas, sometimes having the ability to get the funding to qualify, to get the bonding, or, you know, whatever that the program may call for, you know, they try to keep a barrier between Black people and their children when we want to volunteer and give them social services. So, you know, I think this is a very – I thank you for what you're saying, because this is so important all around. So you just got so many facets of how they capitalize on our children and try to keep that money, that $88,000 or more per child per head, you know, for services. So let me take a couple of calls. We have a call. I'm going to – Brother Daryl. I'm sorry, Brother Derek. Brother Derek. Assalamu alaikum.
Hey, yeah. Wa alaikum salam. And, sister, you're absolutely right, because being one who started a program called Character Building for Life, the TEA in the state of Texas, the school districts are nothing but their cash cow. So they make it very extremely difficult for you to come in and teach anything that's going to awaken the mind of God in the young people. I mean, that is a fact. Because as being one as an educator, and as you look at society, we live in a culture of death. It's a sad reality, but death is in everything. It's an ugly truth. But every human being on this planet walks around carrying their own personal graveyards, each and every one of us. And that graveyard is inside of your brain, because all your thoughts of anything that will raise up the consciousness of the people, bring in the kingdom of God, bring something in new and different, it's all died in your brain, and you're still walking around with it just inside of you. And like brother said, man, you got this whole culture of death that's just sitting there. And you just, in all of us as educators, we just crypt keep. And wow. There's a way to get rid of all of that, but we're going to have to, that's why I use the term, waking up the mind of God. How do you wake up the mind of God? Do you think you can wake up the mind of Master Farah Muhammad with the way we think? We have to, the way you wake up the mind of God is that you have to come up with something new and different, something that no one else is doing or have attempted to do, because we have tried it, they wait. And what have it produced? And I'm not knocking people that have degrees. I love the fact that we have these degrees. But if you step back and take a look at it from God's point of view, every last one of these people that have degrees, look at the society and the world. It's all failing. And guess who's sitting at the helm of it? That's all I call to say.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you raised that. You know, and it goes full circle, though, I think, Brother Derek, because the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan is quoted in this article. He said, you need an education that will make you love you, that will make you see what you have contributed to the onward march of civilization. He said, you need an education that you can use to elevate yourself and your people. He said, and we have scholars. He said, I'm not talking about we Muslims. He said, I'm talking about black people. You know, we have scholars that can devise an educational system for us. You know, so, you know, that is a point that we all have to look at. And we're going to keep on growing, keep on self-improving. And I thank you so very much for your comments.
We're
going
to have to, dear sister. One last point is that the American educational system is based upon the Greek educational system. And just as the scriptures say, as it was in the beginning, so shall it be in the end, where the Greek educational system, their torchlight went out and it all crashed and burned. So it's no accident that this society and their educational system is crashing and burning. So
Thank you so much, sir. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum. Wa alaikum assalam. And so next we have Sister Ula.
Yes, ma'am. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, ma'am. Thank you for calling. Yes, yes, ma'am.
Thank you. I was thinking of listening to the comments that are made, and I thought about how teachers are being, because I know people who are school teachers have stated that they're trying to force them to teach values that are inappropriate for a child even here. And you know what I mean, because I try to be respectful, even though I'm on the call, and I tried several times to get foster children in the city of Cleveland. Each time that I would go in, I noticed so many white people were getting black children, and I'm sure I did the psych evaluation, I passed it. Everything they required, I passed it. But they gave those black children to white children. And those children would look at me so funny when they would see me, because they knew that something in their little nature, they knew they were in the wrong place with them Caucasians. Thank you for letting me share. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. Thank you so much for calling in, sis. So, That's a good point, you know, but again, I think from my time as being an attorney, and I've been an attorney now for 30 years, and what I found that was helpful is that without pay sometimes and having the access, and you can bear witness, Brother Reginald, we can go into these courtrooms for free, and we can observe what's going on with our families for free. You know, we can sometimes, like I say, take the hand of a child and a parent who may be struggling in a community center before you see them getting into a place where law enforcement's gonna, you know, take it. I mean, you already know when you see mothers sometimes struggling, maybe the father's not around, they may not have the best clothes. You already know that if somebody, like Sister Michelle says, doesn't, you know, be a positive role model, perhaps, you know, lend a hand, you know, the outcome. And that is the beauty, I think, of Black people in our communities being able to do outreach with Black people without having to go through a middleman all the time. I mean, what about that conversation? Because we're down to the last several minutes. We got about 15 minutes, and we're talking about solutions. Dr. Harris Madden, I thank you so much because I'm sure you've seen so much because you brought up the social media, and that is such a pet peeve of mine because, as we know, district attorneys' offices, they are filled with social media evidence platforms of youth who may get on, you know, joking and arguing, and the law enforcement, they're looking at that. So social media is something that we have to teach our children the proper use. You know, we got this sex trafficking that is coming out of social media. But peer pressure and impulsivity of youth, I think sometimes that is such an area where our children are being taken advantage of, where y'all talk about, you know, they're children, they make mistakes. That's just something that I think we really have to really start teaching as much as we can in the community, that our babies deserve the right to, you know, not be incarcerated. So, Brother Reginald, you've been quiet. Did you want to make any more statements?
And it goes back to what I was saying. You know, like I said earlier, and I'm glad that the sister's on point earlier. You know, and the solution part about it. You know, we can't move forward until we deal with the root cause in all the areas of how do we treat trauma, and to get safety and make our children and our community safe places. Again, just like you said, the impulsive behaviors of the untreated trauma that our community suffers, that we're just almost operating on. We're operating just like Brother Derek said, living a life, a death style instead of a lifestyle, because most of our young people are always hyperventilant in their life. You know, they're paranoid in all the areas, they're emotional. So it was a program that I really, really respect out of California by Father Greg Boyce. He put together a program called Homeboy Inc., where everybody that come out these institutions, everybody that come out the juvenile facilities, he got a one-stop shop for all of them to come in to deal with people with love and lived experience. Everybody come through the door, you greet them with love. Love is the medicine for trauma. And once we start healing the trauma part of our children, we can get them back relaxed to where they will listen to us. Right now, we don't even have them to listen to us because too busy trying to medicate their pain. So if we're going to deal with anything dealing with solution-based, we got to be serious. We got to come out the box, even when it comes to dealing with the courthouses. We have to put courageous judges in there that's willing to go against a system and not be worried about being reelected.
Yes,
we're in a terrible time right now to where
even in the prison system, they can't keep prison guards because the prison guards that work in there 8 hours a day can't work there no more because of the PTSD that they get from just working in the system. So we're in a time of seriousness, and if we as a community go effectively make sure that our children move to the next level, we got to build a safe place around the adverse trauma that they have experienced in these neighborhoods and these schools, and with this, you can't cut the TV on.
No, he cheats out.
Okay, I think I don't hear him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it dropped, but he was really hitting on it because I was looking at the final call, which this week's final call is entitled Diversity of Expression and Thought Taking Center Stage in Hip Hop. So when he's talking about these negative images on TV, you know, because our children are genius. Our children are creative. Our children, we're the, you know, builders of civilization, mathematics and, you know, hip-hop, like Brother Terrence on Elevated Places said last week, you know, August the 11th was the anniversary of hip-hop. So that genius that is in us, sometimes this media, this music, this drugs are actually, you know, turning them against us. So, again, we have to be brave enough to protect our children in our homes from the music, you know, from listening to any and everything, from watching all of these TV shows that are really putting out negative imagery, you know, some of the fighting, the girls fighting, the girls wearing any type of clothes. I mean, we got to be real because this is what puts them at risk. Sister Nichelle, I know you have something to say. You've been holding your tongue over there like, yes.
30 seconds, not even, Sister. Years ago, I talked to a very smart attorney. Said, you know, she had studied young people, and she said, our children are something what we call they're multi-judicial. And she goes, what that means is they have the ability to...
You kind of going out. What you say, sis? Yeah, I can't hear you.
Okay. When you can't hear me?
We can hear you now. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, yes. She said that there's something called multi-juvenile, that our children are multi-juvenile, and that speaks to what we know as the minister teaches in this hour, and the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad talked about is the ability of these children to do different things. They're masters. And when they're in a school system that doesn't challenge them, they become problems because they're not being stimulated on the level that they should be. So they have the ability to do 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 things at one time, but yet we're giving them some simple language something, and they get bored. And so I just wanted to mention that about how genius we are, as you just discussed.
Yes, ma'am. No, you're so right. And so, you know, we've had a show on the education, and as Muslims, we believe in independent educational, you know, that those are choices that people should exercise if they would like to. We have options. And as we look at sending our children back into what can sometimes be a pipeline to the prison, you know, masquerading as education, you know, our children do have to be informed. The parents have to be informed. I think on pure legal issues, we need to make sure that our parents are aware that their children should not make statements if they are ever pulled into situations with law enforcement. You know, what is exactly custodial interrogation has become an issue. But anytime you're stopped and questioned by the police, I think we need to inform how we do need to exercise our rights to remain silent. I used to tell people that, you know, children, because of their they're not as you know, as mature as adults, and sometimes they may get intimidated. So one of the best things to, you know, just say is, I want my mom, I want my dad, you know, go ahead and and, you know, act as if you are a child and you know that you're no match for an adult. So tell your children to always call you no matter what it is, if whatever questions that they may have. The parent, you know, we're all just phone calls away today. And too many times these law enforcement, we see them. Another article in the final call is about a policeman shooting an 8-year-old Fanta Billity who was shot outside a football game in the Delaware County Courthouse in Delaware. And so, you know, these are situations that our children are going to possibly be seeing. They're seeing it on the news. They're seeing it in their real lives. And we just need to equip them with things to save their lives and not make them at risk.
And if I,
you know, that's what I wanted to say. And I thank the panel. It has been a very, very illuminating and inspiring conversation with you, Dr. Jamiah Harris Madden. I don't know if you're still with us, but I really do. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. We really, really appreciate you taking your time that you spend, you know, helping our youth get the services they need in your county. We just want to thank you so much for taking the time to come on and share your knowledge with us.
Well, it's really hard to say no to Sister Nichelle. She just gives of herself. Judge Nichelle has given to herself. The people. But I wanted to just add, I enjoyed myself tonight, and I thought everyone was insightful. But to your point, I was trying to push in. There's this book called The Stereotype Threat, Interrogations and False Confessions. And it's really interesting because, you know, it talks about the various, you know, stereotypes and the beliefs that one social group has, and I'll talk a little faster, but specifically when young people are picked up, that stereotype threat coupled with hopelessness and starting to believe that, you know, the perceptions of the stronger person or the person that has the power and the evidence that they allegedly have against them plays right into this threat, just as it does with, you know, deception, quite honestly. It goes hand in hand. So if you ever, you know, are reading about more about it, I know you both are, you know, well-versed in the law and all of the tactics that happen. But for a novice like me in that area, you know, just looking at, you know, readings that speak to those things is so important, because then we can better arm our young people so that if and when they are stopped or they are interrogated, they do not play into that stereotype threat that so many of our young people, when you mention the Exonerated Five, that's exactly what happened. So thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for telling us that. And so you say the book is entitled Stereotype Threats? Yes,
it's
ma'am.
About stereotype threats. So it's called Interrogation and the Minority Suspect.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for that. Yes, ma'am. So we're going to end. This has been a very enlightening conversation. Again, I would like to thank you, Dr. Jamiah Harris Madden, Brother Attorney Deshaun X. Peoples, Brother Reginald Gordon with Operation Outreach Empowering Youth, and Sister Judge Nichelle Muhammad. Thank you so much. You know, you are the co-host, and you just constantly add such value to the Elevated Places Network, presenting the Time for Justice. And as our sister said, you're taking of your valuable time, and we thank Allah for you for bringing us this guest this evening. And I would also like to thank the listeners and the callers who took the time to call in and listen every week. We thank you so much. I would also like to make sure everyone remembers to listen to Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad. Her show comes on Thursdays at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. That's Ask Dr. Ava. I would like to thank Samaya Muhammad, who is my producer, and I would like to invite you all to visit our Blog Talk Radio, where you can listen to the replays of our shows. So thank you once again for listening, and tune in next week for more informative discussions. As-salamu alaykum.
Wow, listen, thank you so much. And beautiful panel.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Harris Madden. I really appreciate you coming.
You do a lot.
Oh, my God.
A lot.